Welcome to another episode of Adoption, The Making of Me.
I'm Louise Brown.
And I'm Sarah Reinhart.
Make sure to find us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook as Adoption, The Making of Me podcast.
You can also find us at our website, adoptionthemakingofme.com.
And please remember to subscribe, share, and review wherever you get your podcasts.
Thank you.
In today's episode, we will be discussing I Would Meet You Anywhere by Susan Keo Ito, and we will bring on fellow adoptee Victoria. Stay tuned.
Hi, Louise.
Hi, Sarah.
We just wanted to let our Patreons know and our hopefully future Patreons that our next Zoom group, our coffee clutch, as it were, will be April 6th at 1 p.m. Eastern time.
Yep. Do the math. Be there. We'll send a link. We've been sending a calendar link. So you'll get, if you join Patreon, we'll send you the link via email and calendar. You just have to join at the $10 level.
Yep. $10 level gets you monthly access to a really, really great group on Zoom. It's really fun. It's just, really.
You know what's
really
even like better about it is you could bring a cup of coffee to it in your new At Mom coffee mug.
Yes. If you want to get your new another great episode At Mom coffee mug.
That's the $15 level.
Yeah. You can check out our merch.
Yeah. It'd be really cool to see you there because it's been awesome. I'm looking forward to it. I thought
Me
it was
too.
Coming
I always
up.
Look I forward excited. To it.
Yeah.
Okay. See you in a minute.
Hey, it's Autumn, and if you haven't heard about Foglift by now, you are late because guess what? Foglift stands for fear, obligation, and guilt, and we are lifting that off of adoptees' shoulders for good in a fun, interactive, electrifying live event called Foglift, and we're bringing it to
Sweet Home Chicago
on May 17th and 18th. So join us for a special live podcast episode of The Making of Me with Sarah and Louise and a screening of my film, Reckoning with the Primal Wound, with cast members like Paul Fronczak, a.k.a. Jack.
I'm going to be there. You don't want to miss this.
Experience interactive surprises and engaging moments firsthand. Secure your early bird tickets now for an unforgettable weekend.
So just to reiterate what Autumn and Jack were saying is that we are having Foglift coming to Chicago May 17th and 18th weekend. Friday evening will be a live podcast, and we are going to, this is where you listeners come in. If you want to be that live guest, we're going to do a random drawing. So email us at themakingofmepodcast@gmail.com. Again, makingofmepodcast@gmail.com to put your name to enter to be a live guest. Isn't that exciting? Like, we've never done a live podcast.
Oh my gosh.
So.
It makes me nervous and excited all at
up once. On stage. So just know that if you're signing up for this, be comfortable being in front of an audience of hopefully a couple hundred people. So the other piece to add to this is that early bird tickets are on sale now until April 1st. You're going to get the whole weekend, including the movie, after party, happy hour, live podcast, and then another special event on Saturday that we will reveal later, all for $125.
Yeah. That's a deal.
It's really a deal.
Especially when you find out what the special might be as well. You're getting a lot for it. I'm excited. I'm like, I'd sign up. 100% if I wasn't part of it.
So early bird tickets and sign up for the contest. We'll put the link to the tickets in our show notes. But again, if you want to be on the podcast live, submit to themakingofmepodcast@gmail.com. Thank you.
Thanks. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, Louise. So here we are. We are getting close to the end of I Would Meet You Anywhere by Susan Keo Ito. We are discussing I Would Meet You at a Wedding, followed by Origami, followed by Undertow. So the wedding is, we ended last episode with when she went to Mika's graduation party and she met Kaz. Brother. And we were speculating that he might know who she is, but as it turns out, he didn't. So
this whole time, he thought she was a friend with Mika.
Yeah, the one friend that's in all the family pictures.
That he never saw before until like later years.
Yeah. Strange. Like suddenly she appears. So now he's getting married.
Yeah.
And has invited her to the wedding.
I was kind of surprised she was invited, honestly. And then she said to Yumi, well, does he know that I am his sister? And she said, no. And she said, well, this might be a good time to tell him. And she did. Mm-hmm. I'm always impressed that Yumi does come through and tells people. It's like kind of funny. And then he was excited. Like, oh,
yeah.
Hi,
he's
sis.
Like, hey, sis. Yeah.
She's like, didn't you know? He goes, no. I'm like, okay, that's such a funny
and,
thing.
And by now, so Susan has her daughter, Molly, who mm-hmm. is 9 months old, right? So he takes Molly to the wedding and she's staying at mm-hmm. Yumi's house and bouncing around, but she's not seated at the family table. So it's obvious right. that nobody knows except the immediate family.
It's like old friends of hers, and they say to her, how do you know Yumi? And she doesn't say I'm her daughter because she feels like that's her contract, her quiet contract or something. Mm-hmm.
Also, we didn't mention that Kaz has a baby, which plays in because then one of the wedding guests, you know, Susan comes over, or Yumi comes over and is holding Molly. And mm-hmm. one of the wedding guests says, oh, is this your granddaughter? And Susan and Yumi's, the veil kind of yes. comes up and she goes, no, it's not. She's a family friend or, you know, just
she's
whatever.
The house guest.
She's
daughter.
My house guest daughter. And that just Ooh. Crushed Susan, just crushed her.
It crushed me to read because I was thinking if someone said, I'm the house guest.
Yeah.
It's not even like, I don't know what, it's just a very strange word to pull out. And then she said something like, oh, she is beautiful to lighten
it. Yeah, but she is beautiful, but the damage was done. And then Susan ends that chapter mm-hmm. by saying she never goes back to that house.
Yeah.
Of course, we don't know why.
No, the next morning, Molly and I flew to California. We would never be back.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that crushed me. I was like, you know, really, we're at this stage. You look like these people. Do people care? I mean, I think people had lives. She's a grandmother's age now. If you were somewhere and I didn't know you very well and you said, oh, and this is my grand, I'd say, oh, I didn't know that. This is exciting. How neat.
Right.
To meet you. I would never think twice.
Nobody would like
us.
Flee the room and just. No. Dear God, and like run away, you know?
No, but it's just so deep, I guess, in psyche.
You call it you. Yeah.
Yep. So the next one's called Origami. And this was cute, actually. This was neat, I thought. She and her sister, Mika, go on a bus for like a 4-day thing, not some like quick tour. They go for 4 days to stay up and learn about the concentration camps, the actual work camps.
Yeah, the internment camps for the Japanese during World War II.
Yeah.
Which is just horrible. Her parents mm-hmm. weren't affluent enough, right? To have been taken. That was kind of what
no
I was
property.
Reading.
They were renters. Yeah.
They were renters, didn't own their own business. So they, you know, they were kind of left alone. But I think somebody they knew was just taken from his shop and their minister. Yeah.
Why he was like
horrible.
In the middle of a sermon or something. Yeah. Horrible. So, you know, what's interesting is we used to live on the area, you know, very well in Los Angeles off Sawtelle, which is all Japanese culture and homes. And we met so many of our neighbors, my husband and I, that all recame and brought back to that area from the camps. And all of them had to sell those beautiful properties, all that space. They're just renters now. Some were able to rebuy. Well, they're doing a class action lawsuit coming up. Wow. So I thought of this because this played into this. I was thinking it's such a dark period of our history that we don't really realize what happened. And their sons are fighting in the war.
Mm-hmm. I know.
These are American citizens. I mean, it's just horrible. Okay.
That was
Oh, and the reason it was called Origami is because she has to sit. This was kind of cute. She has to sit with all these older women. One day, Mika goes off on a hike and she sits with all these like older women who are talking in Japanese about her. And she can tell that, oh, she's half Japanese or whatever the name is. And she's trying to fold the origami bird that's like on the front of the book here. And she's like, my hands are too big. I can't do it. They're going to know I'm
like
not Japanese.
Yeah, like I have my father's hands and they probably see the hair, you know, I have the hair on my arms.
And I'm not Japanese enough kept coming up with her. And I just think that's another thing with adoptees is like, I'm not part of this culture really, but I am. You are Japanese. That's why you're there. But it's like, I can't make the bird. That was, but then this cute older lady couldn't make the bird either.
Yeah.
She was Japanese.
Yeah.
Fully. So, yeah.
Yeah.
And we have Undertow.
Undertow, which was talking about the sandwich generation, you know, when your parents get old, but you're also still taking care of kids. And yeah, and her father had an aneurysm. Yeah. And so she went back and forth to New Jersey from California. And ultimately he ends up paraplegic.
Yeah. He ends up having infections. And I related to this a lot with my own dad. I loved him so much. And I had a lot of feelings she has about it. And it's like, I don't know. It's just, he was such a, the reason it's called Undertow is because he had a.
Right. That story experience. From.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. He left her because she was going to drown him when she had gotten taken in the undertow. And
yeah. Okay. Him. Let's maybe explain that a little bit. They had gone on a trip and Susan was out. She was 15 and out swimming and loving every minute of it. And then as she went on, kind of forgetting where she was, she realized how far away she was and she couldn't keep swimming. And what was she going to do? And she thought she was going to drown. And then her dad came and he's like, Susan, stay. And she's trying to grab onto him. He's like, I'm not strong enough. I'm going to drown. Stay here and I'll go get help. And she was like, no, don't leave me. And then he did bring help. He brought
in
a ton of soldiers, right?
Yeah.
And they got her out and then she kind of forgot the incident.
Yeah.
Didn't think anything of it, but it just tore him up for all those years. And
he could hear her weekly, like crying. Yeah. Don't leave me.
What a sweet man.
So that's parent guilt, man. You do something that haunts you.
Yes.
Yes. And the one thing, it was very interesting because Yumi came to the hospital and prayed and said hi to them and paid her respects there. Yeah. And I was like, okay, well, there's Yumi again. Yeah. She didn't say much about her in that, but that she'd come there. This was mostly just about her and her dad and him saying, oh, the thing that she said, this was interesting. I did have that here. He said, Suze, this is what her father was saying to her. I had made a promise I would never leave you. A promise. You were so small, you had already had enough of that, of being left.
Yeah.
What a big acknowledgement.
I know. So rare, especially for that time of adoptive parents to be so open and aware. Remember it? And just the whole helping her find Yumi, you know, just everything that being open to Yumi and very, very rare for that era. And even now from things we hear, people are not so open like that still.
We talked about it today. Nope, they aren't.
Yeah. So it's really.
Well, we are getting to the end and soon we are. Susan
so,
one.
Well, next week we'll read up to part three. So we've got three short, very short, like we're barely reading. And then I think we'll tackle. We probably have a couple more weeks, I think. We'll talk about this. Right now, we're going to
read to part three.
Part three. Then we'll figure that out.
Perfect. All right. And let's stay. Victoria's next. She's great.
Yes. Love Victoria. Okay.
See you in a minute.
Hello. Today, we have an adoptee coming to us from Brooklyn. I'd like to introduce Victoria Rich. Victoria, nice to have you.
Thank you so much for having me. You feel very familiar to me already because I listened to so many of your episodes. So
it's funny when people, you know, I met a woman up here who's an adoptee and she just for a while was like, this is so weird because I know you, but you don't know me. And I'm like, that must be weird. Like for me, it wasn't weird at all, but
we're a big fish in a tiny pond.
Yep. Yeah. I mean, it's like, it's also nice to have like we're all in the same club though. Yes. So.
Yes, exactly.
It is. It's neat. It is a club that no one gets, right? Unless you're in the club.
It's like we're so
we
exclusive.
Don't know anything about you, which is that's how we roll, is that we want to be authentically in the story when you're telling it. So launch on in. Tell us your story.
So I guess I'll start from the beginning. So I was born in 1970 at the Our Lady of Victory Infant Home in Lackawanna, New York. It's right outside of Buffalo. and my parents couldn't have kids because my mom had endometriosis. They mm-hmm. met as kids and grew up on the same block in Brooklyn, and they married in 1950. So they were definitely much older. I'm now 53. They got married when they were 24, which was also pretty old for that time. And they were the type of people who definitely wanted to follow the traditional path of babies. So this was a hard thing for them, not having, being able to have kids. And yeah, it was very different at the time. And a lot of people around them were having kids. And I remember my mom telling me that people would say things to them like, you know, like, why, what's wrong with you? Why can't you give him a child? Why can't she give you a child? Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's just, mind your own business. Like, it's so hurtful. But they did wait for a long time to come to decide to adopt. I think part of it was the stigma at the time. And also, my dad wasn't sure that he could love a stranger's random child. Spoiler alert, he did. He got on board and was a very loving father. But they were also really Catholic. And as you know from reading American Baby, there was like a lot of shenanigans around, you know, the commodification of this. Yeah. So they wanted to go through, you know, like a more like reputable and Catholic source. So I'm not sure how they found it, but at some point they found the OLV infant home and they adopted my brother, Joe, in 1967. Because also it's like, oh, our firstborn has to be a boy.
Yes, very traditional. It's yeah, like it's boy like boy and girl spaced yep. out.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yep. And so that's, so they got Joe and, you know, they were 40 when they got him, which was,
oh, wow. A, that is,
which is like, that's so much older then, right? Like I'm
then that's very
now old. And like looking at pictures, like I look so much younger than they did, but you know, people were already grandparents when they were 40 back then. I mean, right. you can still be grandparents now at 40, but you know what I'm
less,
saying?
Less common. And just, you said, spoiler alert, he did. So I'm assuming your dad loved Joe.
Yes, yes. Okay. And I think, you know, because they were so old, like they did have a lot of nieces and nephews. So they were able to be like, you know, super aunt and uncle because, you know, they didn't have kids. And then I guess everything was going well with Joe. And then they were like, we want to add to the family. And now we want the girl. So they applied for another child and they got me in 1970 and they were 43. So for that, like, you know, we had a lot of aunts and uncles who were already done raising their kids. So we had that and that was pretty nice because they could give us some more attention than, you know, they might have.
Yeah, like a big family with all these.
Yeah.
And you're the youngest.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes. And yeah, I am. Actually the youngest of all my cousins, which is because now I found out that I'm the oldest and my other family. Anyway, but we'll get ahead to that. But our parents, they always told us that we were adopted and I never had any issue with it. I was also like an artsy, weird kid. So, you know, anything that made me a little bit different was fine with me. My brother had some negative feelings about it. We never really talked about it, but we
did. You get along growing up?
Like, not really.
I mean, here's four.
3 years older.
Unrelated. No, I'm saying four people in the family that are not biologically related. And
yeah. So we didn't really get along. He was really mean to me, but like in like the regular older brother sort of thing. It wasn't like anything too weird. Like, I would definitely consider us like, you know, a normal family, you know, and it's like the issues that came about would be issues that would happen in biological families too, right?
And were you in Brooklyn growing up?
We were in Floral Park. So it's half Queens and half Long Island. Mm-hmm. So, you know, they had to go 8 hours away to get us from Buffalo. But they always told us, you know, we got the message that I've heard people say on the podcast before, you know, that we're special, that we're chosen, that our birth mothers loved us, but couldn't take care of us, you know, which is, it was nice to have that acknowledgement too of that existence because, you know, I think if I'd found out I was adopted when I was, you know, a teenager, when everything is horrible, like, yeah. So it was never anything bad for me. I do remember being little and like, some of my cousins, we were outside playing and, you know, one of them was just like, you're adopted. And I was like, duh, yeah, I know. And so it was never anything for me that was shameful or weird. I think my mom, she had a really hard childhood. Like my mom was born in 1926 and her mother died of tuberculosis, you know, during the whole tuberculosis epidemic. So I think my mom was around 3 when her mother went away, but that was to go to the TB sanatorium. And so she grew up, she had an older sister and a younger brother, and they were just kind of like shuttled around between different family members, and their dad was going to put them into foster care, which was horrible, but they ended up getting taken care of by an aunt in Brooklyn. So I think she definitely had an idea of what she wanted, you know, this like perfect family to look like.
She didn't have it, so she wanted to create it.
Yeah. And, you know, and also like the expectations of having waited so long for these kids. Sure. So that, you know, for me a little bit, you know, I guess I wasn't like the girl child that she had envisioned, but you know, people do this also in their biological families as well. So you put your own expectations onto your children, but I definitely relate to things I've heard you talk about, you know, families at this time, like there was no manual for how to parent an adopted baby. You know, you're just given this baby and it's supposed to be like blank slate and, you know, kind of like tofu. It's just blending in like with whatever around it. Yeah.
So that's good. And, tofu.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm gonna like, this is a spoiler, but that's my birth mother used that. So we have to give her credit for the tofu. But you know, like there wasn't a lot of consideration of like, you know, where this stranger baby came from.
No,
you know,
it just was kind of like, you're there.
Yeah. I mean, people really, you, really did let's move on. Kind of believe in the blank slate they thing.
Yeah. Yeah. But like,
except they do, but then you don't really fit. Like, I know for a fact I wasn't everything I was supposed to be all the time, you know, blending in, trying, yeah, not working. And it's like, everyone must see that, but I guess everyone has their delusions, right?
But like the thing that always I struggle with is like, what is from being adopted and what is just from being, you know, a person, because a lot of people in their biological families feel this way too, where it's just like, I'm different from my siblings or I'm different from my parents. And I don't feel it.
So. But it's a different.
It is. I mean, it is a different.
There's no, I mean, just from anecdotal experience and talking to so many people, it's a little different. I don't know that biological people feel that they don't belong in a deeper way in their family.
Yeah.
I agree with that. Yeah. Only because I had that conversation with my husband recently, who's like, well, I'm kind of out of it in my family. I'm like, yeah, but when you're with your family, you're so with your family.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's
even
like,
if you're not fitting, you're fitting.
There's looking alike. There's expressions,
reactions, and
things that as adoptees you don't have. I mean, there's a marked difference in feeling different as an adoptee.
Yeah. And like not seeing, you know, like people who look like
mirror.
Right. I mean, thankfully, I don't know what magic the infant home was doing with their placements, but like we looked enough like a matching family. You know, my brother and I look mostly, you know, somewhat alike, right? Like we're both tall with dark hair and dark eyes. You know, we looked enough like our parents. So, you know, it wasn't even like a transracial thing where you're just like, okay, like these are definitely not your biological children. So we were fortunate in that way. But, you know, I definitely felt not in the right place or, you know, like everywhere, you know, until I went away to college and I went to art school and, you know, just found like my weird artsy
world.
Yeah. Yeah,
I wanted to ask you something about your brother, and not to tell his story at all. Just now, do you still have a relationship with your brother, and is he still searching in his world?
Yes. So we are really close now. So once he went away to college, we became very close, and we're very close as adults. He does not want to look. He's never been interested in it. Like we've had to talk about it a little bit more recently because of my circumstances, but someone did say something to me that maybe he intuited something from his DNA that made him think it, like, know that it was not okay to look and to think about it. And like where I intuited something that made me think it was okay. I mean, I know that sounds like kind of woo-woo, but I think there is something there. Like, you know, we do hear about DNA trauma imprinting on DNA. So who knows?
Who knows? Right?
Some people just don't have any interest. And, you know, as you guys know, this is such a personal and individual journey.
I just wondered if you were still close too.
Yeah, we definitely are. Our parents are both dead. Our dad died when I was 23 from complications from a brain tumor surgery. And our mom died in 2014 after like a 10-year battle with Alzheimer's. So we definitely bonded over being adopted during those times, because we're just like, well, we're not like, we don't, we're not going to inherit these things from them. Yeah. So he and I also share kind of like a dark sense of humor about it. But we are going to like the nature and nurture thing. Like in some ways we're very different. Like he's like a very corporate business type and I'm like a creative person, but we're both really, really practical and like have high sense of responsibility and work ethic. And so it's like, is that how we were raised or you don't know?
Yeah. I know. That's weird. All of it.
Yeah. So my journey into starting to research or look for where I was from, you know, I was always curious about things like heritage, but I never really wanted to look, partly because maybe I would find out something terrible, but mostly because the thinking at the time was just like, you just wouldn't look. You know, we definitely got the message. It'd be too painful for the birth mother. Like she blocked it all out. Like, you know, and also at the time, like there was really not as many ways to find someone, right? That there are now.
Yeah, I had like a lot of subtle messages. Like no one really said, don't look, but it was all kind of like, that will be painful. That will be painful.
Yeah.
Everyone around you shouldn't be disturbed type of thing.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's like, in some cases it shouldn't, but it's, you know, it's really complicated.
Or should it? And you still find out about yourself. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
Well, look, everybody, we're in 2024. Everybody has a right to know their medical history, who they are. I mean, it's just, this shouldn't even be, Pandora's whatever.
Could be ugly, but whatever.
Should be opened because we get to know. It's just, anyway.
Even if it's bad, you know.
Strong feelings about that.
Same, but it is very complicated. But in 1999, I read a book review of this book called Can You Wave Bye Bye Baby by Elise Gasco. And there's a mention of quotes, one of those places, you know, you've seen the same movies I have. It's a home for these pregnant unweds and an institution for children with Down syndrome, a kind of catch-all clubhouse for the lost and stigmatized. And that really hit me hard because it was like, whoa, like that's where I spent the first 3 months of my life, plus more in utero. And it talked about like the rows of cribs and it really struck me because I just started to think like, how did this form me? You know, I was in this institution being taken care of by nuns and strangers. You know, like I've always been really self-reliant and independent. And those are definitely not bad qualities to have. But like, did that come from me forming and just being like, okay, you're on your own, you know, like you don't know.
When you start to think about yourself as an infant, I get very... because that's only been recently for me. You think about, whoa, what were those first days? I was with my biological mother. She had to go to court, hand me over after 6 days. Like, what was I doing? How, you know, you start to look at yourself. So you're thinking of yourself in these cribs, in this institution. It's like a wake-up call, right? Like, whoa.
Yeah, because I had never imagined that. And, you know, of course, like when you're young, you're not envisioning that aspect of your life.
No.
But at this time, I was also in an MFA photo program, and I was thinking about my thesis project, and I was like, oh, this would be an amazing project to photography. So I knew that the infant home was still in existence, but it was now like a 24-hour care facility for kids who needed physical help. So I contacted them, asked if I could do a shoot there, and they said that I could if I took pictures of their basilica in exchange. And I was like, sure, this is great. So I did 3 visits there and took pictures. And they even arranged for me to meet a nun who had been the main nun there for 40-something years, Sister Veronica Ann. So she would have been caring for me and my brother while we were there. So when I was going there, I was curious how I was going to feel in the space because I was there. I think I was there.
You were in the space. Yeah.
I was in the space for quite some time. But it was sort of oddly not personal. It just really felt more like the collective weight of all the women and girls that were in that place and ultimately had to give their babies away. You know, like there were all these empty bedrooms. So the place where the girls were on the upper floors and like the current kids were on the lower floors. So there were, you know, there were delivery rooms that were just now used for storage and the bedrooms were
empty. Do they still look like it though?
Yes. And I can send you pictures of this from this project. Like, there's one room that has a blackboard, and it was like, oh, of course. They were probably going to school because a lot of them were teenagers. And there's one, like a stack of examining gowns, and there's an exam table, you know, like gynecological exam table. But it also, like, there were like a border on the wall of like angels, because it's also really Catholic. So that, you know, and then like a living room with comfy couches for them to be sitting on it. And so like, you just think of like how many women were there over the time when this
such an institution. It's so weird.
Yeah. And
factory,
a
factory or something.
Yeah. Yeah. And I always assume that, you know, because you hear stories about these places that they're horrible and they're negative. And when I interviewed the nun, I did a video of her, like, she was just really positive and really caring too. And she was talking about how, like, the majority of the girls who were there were just like really good girls who had made a mistake. Yeah. And it seemed
that
like,
language is.
Yes. I know. But it wasn't like, you know, she wasn't like, these sluts deserve to get their babies taken away. Like, it seemed like very caring. And so I was like, okay, like, that's, you know, that's good to know that this is how it started.
Well, at least she was caring, right? You met someone that maybe was loving or gentle nature or something.
Yeah. But what was wild while I was there, the woman gave me a copy of, like, what they did an assessment of me. I guess they would do that about, you know, like an 8 week for your skills. It's like, do your eyes follow someone or like, and it was really weird. I had known my original name. It was Bridget Lynn Wolf. So, you know, this document just kept referring to Bridget. And I think it was 8 weeks old. And it did say that, like, I pretty much only cried when I was hungry. And I was just like, okay, that tracks. Like, I like to eat. So, yes. But
that's a beautiful name, by the way, Bridget Lynn. Yeah. It's pretty.
Bridget
and
Lynn,
Victoria's pretty. You have pretty. Yeah,
yeah,
both of them.
Yeah, it's weird. It's just like, who would Bridget be? Who would Victoria be? We'll never know. I mean, no, we do know who Victoria is. But I still, at this point, wasn't thinking of looking for my birth mother. I think because of all those fears of violating privacy. But then I read The Girls Who Went Away when it came out around 2007. And it just... Have you read it yet?
It might be one of our next books.
Okay. It's on our list.
Yes, it should be. Like, it's
we've
it's
done
great.
A,
it's,
we did American Baby, and then we kind of needed a break from the era.
It's definitely a heartbreaker. Get ready. Yeah. But the book shocked me because so many of the women interviewed said things like, "I think about that baby all the time. I worry about that baby every day." And like, that was not what I was led to believe. So that nagged at me for about a decade. And then I just started to think that I would just be an irresponsible person if I didn't try to alleviate that worry for whoever she was, you know. So I spent probably about 10 years like weighing those options about blowing up someone's life who might not want to be found. And like, there's no going back. And this is, you know, just like a life altering thing, good or bad. So, and, you know, I knew that she was a teenager. Oh, because I got non-identifying information from the infant home that didn't provide a lot of insight, but I knew she was a teenager. So if I was in my mid-40s at this time, like, time was ticking and there's a likelihood that she might not
She'd
be
probably
around.
Be only like in her early 60s or something, late 50s, really.
No, yeah. She was talking about back then, right? That
yeah.
You were
so
in your,
yeah.
You were in your mid-40s.
Yeah, like that's when I started like really thinking, which would have been mid, like maybe around like 2015 or so. I was just like, okay, like I got to get this rolling. So, you know, and I just started to think like finding out something terrible might be worth the risk of being able to alleviate this. For years, I was doing like the rando searches like OLV, August 20th, 1970, Bridget Lynn Wolf, and didn't turn anything up. I did the SoundX registry, didn't turn anything up. I did in 2019 Ancestry and didn't get any high matches.
Oh, nothing.
Yeah.
Wow. That's when I did it, 2019. I got lots. You didn't have anything on there.
Like nothing that was high enough to be like, hey, can you help me out here? Yeah. So, but New York State was going to pass their original birth certificate law in 2000. So I applied. And while I was waiting for it, I remember I was in a bunch of adoptee like Facebook groups, and like everyone was losing their minds, like rightfully, because we're just like, yes, like we're finally going to get this information. But I started thinking, like, what about like all the birth moms? Like, how are they feeling about it? Like, are they nervous? Like, are people, how are they reacting to knowing that they're going to be found? So I did post that in one of the groups that had adoptees and like bio moms. And like, luckily, like a few women were just like, I would definitely want to be found. I think this is great that, you know, the secrecy is being lifted. So that gave me the courage to.
Yeah. To hear look. From others. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I was just like, okay, this is all I need to know. So I composed my, so I got my birth certificate and there was no father on there. It was just bio mother, birth mother. So I found her and I wrote her a letter and I tried to write it in a way that was just like vague. And, you know, if like, cause I didn't know her situation. Like, you know, did she,
this is such the adoptee thing though. Like, I don't want anything. Yes. I'm this person. Yes. Like, it just drives me. Like,
yes. Even
I look like, back in horror at things I've written.
Yeah. You're just like, I have to be sensitive about your feelings. I don't want to intrude, but I also think, you know, that's like valid. So I wrote it in a way that if someone found it, that I didn't say like, my name was this, your name is on my birth certificate, blah, blah, blah. You know, I was just like, I was born this date, OLV infant home, never had any problem being adopted. I read that book and, you know, my motivation is just to let my birth mom know that I'm okay and hope the same for her. And I hope this is not an unwelcome intrusion. And then I sent it off and
this is snail mail. You had her address.
I did it UPS. Oh. Yes, I did it UPS. I know, because I'm just like, I want the confirmation that I will get there. And so on the birth certificate, it was Mary Beth Wolf. She's now Mary Beth DeSanto in Erie, Pennsylvania. So the infant, well, okay, we're not going to jump ahead geographically. So 2 days later, I get a call at work. I have my phone up and there's an 814 number coming up, and that's the Erie area code. And I was kind of freaking out because I was like, that was really fast. Like, I was not expecting to get an instant reply from her. So, you know, I'm at work and I'm trying to just be cool, like, hello. But like, I knew who it was because it was obviously her. And she was like, it's Mary Beth. And then there's a long pause. Like, you know, she sounded like she was in shock, as you might be when your daughter from 50 years ago, you know, contacts you. And she's like, I got your letter. And then there was a long pause. And then I was waiting for the worst thing. And she's like, I'm so glad you found me. And I was like, aww. Okay. And I was just like, whatever happens now, this is okay. Like, because I thought she was
going to be
like,
that was the words. Yeah.
Yeah. She's like, I thought she was going to be like, please don't contact me again. And I was just like, okay, like, this is good. So I'm also at work and I'm just like trying to like find a place to go and
so sit private. And have such a big thing while you're at work.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's like 50 years of, and this person that gave birth to you, and then you get the phone call at work. Like,
yeah.
And at the time, like, I'm in an open office, like with all these people having conversations around me. Yeah. So I go, I find a little room and like, it was like, so intense. And she said, like, one of the first things she said was, it's not that I never wanted to look for you. I was just afraid to, that you'd be disappointed in me or that you had a horrible life because of me. Mm-hmm. And like, that was just so like heartbreaking. Cause you know, you're just thinking.
But she thought about that all the time. I'm sure. What have I given her over to? What you read stories in the paper, could have been horrible.
Yeah. And you don't know. And so I mean, she told me, we talked on the phone for about an hour and a half. Like, she told me a lot of stuff. It was just like super, super, super intense and just like, but also really exciting. I'm just like, okay, wow. I'm like going to get to know all this stuff. So she got pregnant when she was a senior in high school around Thanksgiving, and you know, she was dating someone. It wasn't like a serious relationship. I was most likely conceived at a kegger, which is really kind of funny. And then, yay, 17-year-olds. And then
I have a feeling mine wasn't that much different, actually. So it's
yeah. Yeah. I'm sure it was, yeah. I'm sure it was very common. But they'd broken up before she knew she was pregnant. And then when she told him, he was basically like, sorry, it's your problem. Yeah. And, you know, and that was very common at the time. And that's also kind of how I always imagined the situation was. You know, is it because I intuited that, or is it because it was just such a common story that we've heard so often, especially in that era? But, you know, they were in the same class at school, like, and, you know, so they had to sit in classes together. And the last time that they had had a conversation was in March of 1970. And then, you know, she graduated in June, visibly pregnant. And then she went to the infant home the next day, and I was born in August.
And he went on with his life.
Mm-hmm.
That's how it works.
Mm-hmm. Men. I know. It's just like when you read The Girls Who Went Away, like, you're going to hear so many double standard stories like that. But her parents didn't force her to give me away. She's one of seven daughters. And so she's the third oldest. So she had a couple of younger ones. So the youngest sister was 3 and a half. So that's not a lot older than me, but her parents did arrange for her to go to the infant home. And then she gave birth and she got to see me the next day. And then she was like, you know, I'm not going to give you away. But that was also wild for me to hear, because I just assumed that, you know, she gave birth, I was taken away, and then I was just taken care of.
So the second day when she saw you, she's like, no, I'm going to keep this baby.
Yeah. Cause apparently I was just like sitting there on her lap, staring at her, just like, you know, hey, hi. And she was just like, okay, I'm going to keep you. Like, okay. So she called her parents and was like, I'm going to keep the baby. And they're like, okay. And, you know, they started getting things ready because their youngest kid was 3 and a half. So I just would have been like folded into,
yeah, you know, right, yeah,
another sister. And then she thought about it some more and was like, what am I going to do with this baby? I'm 17. I don't have a job, you know, and it's also 1970. And so she didn't want me to be the weird kid with no dad who lived with their grandparents, because it was not so common at the time. And also she did say, and this was really sad, she's like, I didn't want to be your sister. I wanted to be your mother.
And I have a letter to that effect a little bit. Mm-hmm. Oh, I can see that. That's a strange thing too. For her.
And so she thought that a couple who were married, who had more means and more stability, could provide me with something different. But this was interesting. She knew once they placed me, I think I got adopted. Well, my parents picked me up, I guess, in November of that year. So I was at the infant home for about 3 months. But they told her that they had found me a family, and that the family had also already adopted a kid from there. So that, she said, like, gave her a lot of comfort knowing that they already had an adopted kid that they loved, allegedly, and, you know, wanted to do it again. So I think that was something.
So they did tell her that they were giving her that information.
Yeah. Hmm. Yeah. They didn't tell her who those people were, but I think that she said that was something that kind of like brought her comfort over the years, thinking like, okay, maybe, you know, she didn't have a horrible life because she was with these people who were capable of loving another child. Yeah. So that's pretty wild.
Did you continue your relationship with her? Are you still in reunion?
Yes. Yes.
And what did she, all those years after giving you up, did she go on to have more kids? And
yes. Yes. So she had, so one other thing, just to jump back to that, like, so no, it wasn't a secret. She had two older sisters who even went to visit her at the infant home, and they met me, which that also kind of blew my mind, because, you know, I never imagined anyone else around aside her. I was just like, okay, the only person who's going to be thinking about me is whoever she is, but there are all these other people that knew about it and like worried about, you know, Bridget. So she did go on to, she got married, maybe 2 years after she had another kid. She has two other kids, two sons. And this was really sad. So she told me that when she was pregnant with her first kid, like, she was just so paranoid that the baby was going to die because she...
You mean her second kid? You were her first.
I know. That's such a weird
isn't it?
Just to jump ahead, like she, in one of her early conversations, she was like, I can't wait for someone to ask me how many children I have, because now I can say I have two sons and a daughter. Whereas before she was just like, I have two sons. Yeah, I have two children. And for me, that's something that's hard to get used to as
well. You're still getting used to it.
Yeah. Cause on that first phone call, she was in shock. So her voice was kind of like flat. And she was like, you have two brothers. So I thought, you know, kind of like just reciting facts that from, you know, my letter. And I was like, no, I have one brother, Joe. And I was like, oh no, she means she has two kids. I have two brothers. And I'm like, this is going to take getting used to thinking about these other people who are technically my family. So
yeah.
So when she was pregnant with her her second child, she was worried that he was going to die because you know, God was going to be punishing her for you know, what she did the first time, which is just so sad. But you know, she's also at this time, you know, she's 19 or 20, I think maybe 20 or 21.
She said so many messages of like, you know, good girls don't, and you did that now.
Yeah. And she did say she had a baby picture of me. And when she brought her son home, she ripped it up because she was like, I can't think about that baby and like be his mother. So she like ripped up my baby picture, which was really sad. So when we, you know, we're talking, I'm just like, do you want some other baby pictures of me? So we don't have any like very early baby pictures of me, but you know, I gave her all pictures from, you know, once they started taking pictures.
But she had one and now you don't have it.
I know. And she doesn't have it. Yeah. But we have each other now. So that's good.
Yeah, that is
good. And so she went on to, she had a second child and like her husband always knew, like before they got together, he knew about me. And then she told her sons when they were in their 20s. So they knew. Yeah. And so they're, you know, they're not that much younger than me. And then when she and I connected, one of them reached out and was just like, I'm your brother. I always thought I would look for you. And so like everyone's been very welcoming and very open, which has been amazing and also kind of shocking.
And you're not so far into this. I can kind of tell by how you're telling it. I feel like I've been you, but years ago. That's sort of like you're in that, like, I don't know how to do all this with two families thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you're feeling weird about it, but it isn't, it's a process.
Yeah. But like, luckily it was like also positive that it was like, okay, like I'm good with all this, but okay. So here's another interesting thing about this. When we first talked, it was March 5th, 2020. And then like the next week was
shutdown.
The pandemic lockdown. And so two things, like on our first phone call, she had invited me to a wedding in June because she's like, you have so many aunts and they're going to like be dying to meet you. Will you come to this wedding? And I'm just like, yeah, like, why not? But prior to that, my niece was graduating from University of Buffalo at the middle of May, and Erie is only, you know, less than 2 hours from there. And I'm like, I'm going to actually be there sooner. You know, can I
Joe's daughter, you mean?
Yeah. Yeah. So his oldest daughter. Can, you know, can I come then? She's like, that would be great. So then pandemic happened. So those two things didn't happen. But in some ways, like we had like just a lot of time because everyone had a lot of time then too. And like, it was equal, like our lives were equal at that point because everyone is in this lockdown. And we just spent a lot of time talking and texting and getting to know each other and sending each other pictures. And that was great. And like, I don't know.
And you sent us a beautiful thing that happens from that.
Mm-hmm, we'll get to that. but like, I don't know if I would have had that time.
Right.
To devote to this because, you know, I was working and doing a career change. Like I was just like, and life, like busy all the time. So I wouldn't be able to be like, okay, talking, texting all the time. So we got to know each other really well over this time, which was great. And I do think that if we had met in May,
at the wedding or whatever.
Yeah. Like it might have been like awkward because it would just be like, oh, hey, like I don't really know anything about any of you people, you don't really know anything about me. Like, I mean, and these meetings are by nature kind of awkward anyway at first. But then, you know, we were trying to think about like when we could meet. And one of my friends was working on a PBS web series called Self-Evident. And it was a digital series about like what it means to be an American right now. So a lot of things were like not directly pandemic related, but current. So she asked me if we wanted to do an episode, Mary Beth and I, and I was just like, okay. And neither one of us are the types to like seek out attention, but this, you know, PBS, hey, nerd alerts. I love that.
Right. And also, it was a PBS asked, you're like,
Yeah. Cause I'm like, this is going to be cool. It's going to be a short thing. And also like, my friend Lucy, I know she's not going to steer me wrong on something. And there was no crew. We were just going to be shooting it ourselves. So we arranged to do that in August of 2020. But also like my job at the time, I just recently did a career change and I'm a full-time art teacher now. But my job, you know, after, since I was out of college, was doing photo editing and shoot production and photography and shooting video. So this was in some ways like one of my jobs, like one of my shoots that I was very familiar with doing. But now there was this extra layer of like, oh, okay, but I'm also having this reunion
about me,
my birth mother, right? And but like, so I know like I'm like when I'm on a job, I'm like, I'm so like focused on like, okay, we need like the shot list, like we got to get all these things and like, you know, who's doing what. And like, but I'm just like, okay, but I'm also having to experience this thing. So I went there in August of 2020. And, you know, we're doing like filming along the way. And so, yeah, we have our big meeting, our big reunion that had to be captured. So I'm like in a panic, like we have like three cameras, like my partner's with me. He had one. Mary Beth's granddaughter and son have like another. And I'm trying to just be like, oh, hey, but I'm also trying to look because my friend Lucy was just like, this is the shot. You need to have this, like the hug, the first meeting. So I'm just trying to be like, you got your cameras ready? Yeah. So that was really stressful.
You're trying to be in the moment and working. That's
bizarre. Yes. Yeah. That was very weird. And then you have like the awkwardness of like, oh, hey, we've been talking for, you know, 5 months. And like now we're in person. Like, are we going
so
to
like each other? We saw this and you guys are like mother, daughter. It's bizarre.
Freaky. It's yeah. So yeah. Freaky. One of my friends watched it and she was just like, it seems like she just spit you out with
yeah.
like no help from anyone else. Yeah, the wolf DNA is very strong. There is one other sister, like there's an auntie who looks almost more like my mother than Mary Beth does. And that's really freaky. And one of Mary Beth's sons, he and I look like twins. I'll send you this picture because like, even when we were little, it was like, my parents gave me this horrible, do you know who Ted Koppel was? Like,
yes.
Yeah,
Ted
of course.
Koppel. I had a Ted Koppel haircut in like, you know, bicentennial year.
Of all
awful.
People.
Yes. And
that is awful. I haircut. Can picture his hair.
I'm going to send you this picture. And so Mary Beth was sending me pictures of, you know, of like everyone. And she's sending in this one picture of her two sons and it came in like sideways. And I'm like, looking at it on the computer before I could make it vertical. And I was like, how does she have this picture of me? But it was the other son. He had the same exact Ted Koppel haircut, but he was a boy in another family. And even like the same cowlick, it was
at least
crazy.
He was a boy with that haircut.
I know.
A bad haircut.
I had many boy
me
haircuts
too.
Because my mom told me she didn't know how to cut straight hair. So she just cut it short.
That's the same. Yeah. I have thick hair and my mom said she couldn't detangle it. So I just had to.
Yes.
Yep, I cried in the pet store when someone said, I was in fourth grade and there was a boy I had a crush on and I saw him in the pet store. So I went in and the man at the thing, this is not part of your story, says, hello, little boy. May I help you? In front of the boy I have a crush on. That was my hair.
Oh, God. Yeah.
I know. And okay. It's just like.
Ted Koppel is a great reference, though.
Yeah, like people would call me son all the time, and it was, yeah. Anyway.
So yeah. What about your dad, your birth
father?
So he's, like, we are in touch, and, like, that's nice. It's going well. He's actually neighbors with one of, they live two doors down, and, like, they didn't know this connection until recently. So just going back to doing the PBS thing. So during that time, like it was still pandemic. So like we didn't meet with a lot of people, but I did meet like a couple of aunts and you know, like they, when we, Mary Beth wanted to go, she's like, well, we're just gonna drive over to someone's house and surprise them. Just like, so they went over and then they like pulled me out and they're just like, surprise. And apparently I look so much like their mother. So their dad had like very like white blonde hair. So
you mean your, are you meaning your grandmother?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay,
so
okay, the, okay.
Yeah. I know it's tricky with like keeping track of people, but like, so their dad, he had like the very dominant DNA because 6 out of the 7 sisters were all like white blondes and Mary Beth had dark hair. So she was like, you know, the black sheep, but their mom had like very dark hair. And so none of her children really looked like her. And so like now everyone's just like, you look so much like our mother. Like she passed in, I think in like the 80s. And one of the aunts said, like, if I saw you walking down the street, I didn't,
I would
know. If she's like, I would have stopped you and said, like, you look like my mother. Yeah. And so she was Irish. And it was funny, like growing up, I always like felt very Irish and I was raised in an Italian American family. And it's just like, oh yeah, like my name was Bridget. Like how much more Irish could that be? It was just like, okay, I intuited that. But then the next summer when it was 2021, there was a family reunion back in Erie of the Wolves. And so the two aunties who had met me, I'd been in touch with them. Like we were texting and, you know, they were just so nice and so open. So they came in from out of town and like their family is so big because there were 7 yeah. kids. So they have,
that's my
like,
biological father has, he's the oldest like of 7 sons.
It's yeah, it's like so many people. So we went to a like a restaurant and the two aunties, like, you know, it was their first time seeing me. And so like, they just wanted to like, they just kept like staring at me and like wanting to touch me and cry. Yeah. It was really sweet. Cause they were like, we never stopped thinking about you. Like we just, you know,
they're the ones who saw you in the,
yeah. They're like, oh. You know, the last time we saw you, you were a beautiful baby with all this black hair. And like, we just wondered about you and worried about you. And to have that like response to, you know, like, I'm so glad I did this because yes. It's just like to have that response is, it's amazing.
You used the word woo woo before, but I always think there's sort of a, something in the world when you have good energy coming, like Sarah's mom always wanted to have her found. Like, I feel like there's some good energy you must feel in your,
yeah. And I think
keeps like, you going or something.
Yeah. Or like that intuiting of something. And like Mary Beth mm-hmm. said that they would, you know, when they were together, they would talk about Bridget. And so they, all the sisters had been together the year before in 2019. And like, I guess they were sitting around someone's table and like talking about Bridget. Bridget's going to be 50. Like, where do you think she is? And there yeah. were two nieces who were in their 20s at the time who were sitting at the table who had no idea. And so they're texting each other. They're like,
who's Bridget?
Who's Bridget? So they found out that their aunt had a secret baby. So I'd asked her, I'm like, were they shocked to find out you had this secret baby? She said, no, they were more shocked to find out that the father was their neighbor.
Oh gosh.
Yeah. They're just like, oh, that guy? Yeah. So that's
that funny. Would be, yeah. Tell us that. Tell us.
But going to this yeah. party though, being in this party with all these people, like I'm an introvert and like so parties are not, you know, my big thing. So like I'm not ever the person who's just gonna roll up with a bunch of strangers and just be like, hey, hi, I'm here. But I'm in a space with all these people and it was so familiar and comfortable. And every once in a while I would just bug out and just be like, but I don't know these people. Like they're strangers.
Oh yeah.
But,
I've had that but then, too. It's cool though.
But you have that connection. Mm-hmm. You know, you have like genetics are real. Like biology is real. And it's even like the first meeting with Mary Beth, she was just like a couple of family members had come over and she's like, it just feels like you've just always been here.
Yeah.
And that like we
have. My cousin says that to me. We forget you haven't always been here. Like when yeah. I'm there, they used to talk about me too when I was little, which yeah, I didn't know they knew about me, but it's that whole like,
yeah,
you do feel like you've always been there. You just haven't. So you're missing yeah. history, right? Yeah. You are missing the history, but
yeah. So like to get to know all of these people and know things about them and of all this history is very wild and like intense. And I feel very, very, very fortunate because this could have gone like a different way. But on the first meeting, like we had dinner at Mary Beth's house outside and I was inside like cleaning up and all of a sudden I just stopped and like looked at her. I'm like, could you ever have imagined, you know, Bridget being in your kitchen, just like casually loading the dishwasher? And so, you know, just like these everyday things that you get to experience now are like, it's like, they were so intense.
Mm-hmm. So before we wrap up, I definitely want to know how your father reacted. So because back in 1970, he was like, yeah, good luck to you. So
yeah.
What was his reaction now?
Right. So I did send him a letter soon after because Mary Beth was like, oh, he's nice. You should contact him. And, you know, like also like I hear on your podcast, like when you're imagining these things, like somehow I think it's because of like the biological connection, like you think more about your mother, right? You're mm-hmm. just like, so like I never really considered like who that person might be. So when we were, the first time I was on the phone with her, she said like who he was. And I was like, what? And I was like, oh, wow. Yeah. Okay. This makes sense. This is like information she thinks that like someone would want to know. Yeah. So I reached out.
Someone had to fertilize that egg.
Yeah. And he, like, it's just, they had very different life experiences because of their situation. So
I'm same.
Yeah. Like, so sometimes I struggle a bit with that imbalance because,
yeah,
you know, like this was like her formative thing and affected her deeply. And, you know, he never had other children. Mm-hmm. And so I think now he's just like, oh, okay.
Oh, you're his like, only.
I'm his only. Yeah. So he's just like, oh, okay. Like here you are. And, but like he's responded to it positively. So like we've talked, like I've actually met him a couple of times. Like he oddly had an annual trip like for years with his wife. They would come to New York every year in December, you know, to see like some holiday things. So I first met him, I think like 3 Decembers ago, like on one of their first trips. Yeah. Like he's nice. It's positive. It's, you know, like he works in education. Like I work in education now. So like there are definitely like some similarities.
Yeah. Just not the same. It's like building or whatever.
Yeah. It's just, it's different, but it's good and it's positive. And I'm glad to know.
I'm glad it's positive. It.
Yeah.
Yeah. I am glad it's positive because it can build too. Like for him not having children too, my second husband, he doesn't have children. So it'd be weird, like if he all of a sudden had a child, right? That, mm-hmm. I mean, he didn't all of a sudden, he knew, but say this person came in his life or something, I could see him being like, interesting to get to know. Cause if you don't even have the kid connection, you're yeah. like, oh.
I know. And they're men of a certain generation. So it's just like, oh,
exactly.
Like,
yeah.
What do I do with this girl child?
What do I do with this person?
Yeah. So.
Well, I like nice. That. I love that it's still unfolding and it's
yeah, new.
It's yeah.
New process.
It's yeah. And you know, I know it's not always like as accelerated as it's been with Mary Beth. So I think it unfolding in a yeah. more expected timeline. But it's good. Yeah. Like, you know, he's really nice. His wife is really nice. Like she's been very open and welcoming to me. And oh, when I was there last summer, I met one of his who seem really cool. So it's nice also to get to see like the genetics on that side as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much.
I know.
And can we put the link to
yeah, can people PBS see it
in our show?
Yes.
People can
yeah.
see it. Okay, great. Yeah. We'll do
and
that.
And also I'll send you the infant home project as well. Yes. So you can put that link yes. on there too.
Absolutely. 100%.
And I will send you the video of the nun, but let's not post that. Cause it was
okay. Yeah. We don't
when like my first videos I'd made and it was like the quality is so terrible. And I'm just like, oh my God. I wish I could reach
I'd like
you.
To but see
this,
it though.
But the story,
yeah,
the
I want to see it.
Really good. Yeah. But thank you so much.
The PBS thank one you. Was nice to watch. People should watch it. I'll
yeah, no, we'll put it. There. Definitely watch it.
Yep.
Definitely watch it. Thank you so much, Victoria. Okay. Really, yeah, really great to talk
thank
to you.
Thank you.
Okay.
Okay.
Okay. Have a great rest of your day.
You too. Thank okay, you.
Bye.
So great to meet Victoria. And I love her story. It's also so interesting when someone doesn't search until so much later, just because I love hearing those stories of doing this later in life than
me too. It's like real time, really.
Yeah. I mean, really it is. It's only been a couple of years, 3 years or something. So
yeah. And I really do encourage people to watch the PBS because now you'll hear her, but it's also a really neat, it's only 10 minutes or something. It's a neat segment. Yeah, I love anything PBS. If they asked me, I'd say yes too. Prepared or not, 100%. Right?
Yes.
And we want to give a shout out to her bio mom, who's
Mary Beth, who listens to our podcast. And, and after we were off camera, Victoria said that Mary Beth was the one that led her to the podcast. So I think the
shout out, Mary Beth. Yay. We've had some emails. So that's exciting to find out that's you.
Yes. Well, right. Louise,
what do we say? Another great episode.
Another great episode. See you next time.
See you next time.
Thanks so much for listening today.
And remember, if you'd like to share your stories or suggest any guests for our show, you can find us on all the socials at The Making of Me Podcast.
And again, we have a Patreon page so that we can continue to bring these great adoption stories to you. So if you want to find that and donate or contribute in any way, find us at patreon.com searching adoption: The Making of Me.
Bye.
See you next time.